Welcome back, everyone. And first off, I want to thank again all of the speakers for a wonderful and inspiring day of talks. And I'm going to kick off. I've attempted to synthesize a few of the topics that have come up today and initiate a question. If we are not ready to draw the diagram, perhaps we may revisit what appears to me to be a common thread running throughout the day, a notion of matrix, an interstitial zone, holding the potential for new architectures as we radically rethink our approach to sustainability. We may find this concept in developmental biology, eloquently modeled by Conrad Waddington as the epigenetic landscape, an active information scape choreographing code in concert with the production of form. Today, this concept of matrix has surfaced in many of the talks. David Ziegler has asked us to pull in more nature to our unnatural constructions. John has suggested that we manage this landscape matrix to enable the rescue of small populations of species. Birger Svensson has considered the thick boundary within system design thinking. And finally, Michael Henzel talks about architecture as a thickened border of multiple envelopes. So my initial question is, if matrix architecture, or what I would call matrix architecture, is a common goal, are there more appropriate models to incorporate and abstract into our design methodologies and processes over others?
That's a question.
Yes. What are the next steps?
Can you repeat the question?
Just the last thing. Just the last sentence.
So the question is, if matrix architecture, this interstitial zone that seems to be a common thread throughout all of the talks, is a common goal, are there more appropriate models to incorporate and abstract into our design methodologies and processes over others? In other words, how do we edit in our next steps?
I can maybe try. To me, I think we are standing in front of very serious and real problems that we need to address and in a direct way. And we have to find innovation and inspiration in coping with things called real-world problems. As an example, totally different thing. We're working with the issue of disarmament. Some of my students work with disarmament with the UN. Like, what can design do for field workers who now are working in Libya to collect small arms and to avoid the emergency of mafia gangs and these kind of things? These are really serious problems. There's a lot of other examples. So how do we design for that? How do we directly address it? And to me, understanding and grabbing, getting your hands dirty, getting in there, grabbing the problematics and unfolding the complexity, not simplifying, bringing in the knowledge, bringing in the experts, and contributing as designer, this is a field of great innovation, creativity, and doing really a difference in the world. So, to my mind, design as a whole, including architecture, has to go there because there are so many things to do, and for that we need to engage in political, economical, social, cultural, biological problems, and that's our challenge. And a way to do it is to use our design capacity to cope with very complex problems. We just have to focus on what is out there. That's my bet or my 5 cents worth for it.
I'm not sure whether we are, at least in my view, at the stage where we can start editing. I think we haven't perhaps arrived at a good formulation of a question in order to pursue answers at this stage. I think a lot of conceptual groundwork, basic work, needs to be done. Different kinds of conceptual approaches need to be put on the table and debated. And questions need to arise from that rather than premature answers. In my view, we're at the stage where we're trying to get a hold of promising questions that bring us a step further. And maybe if there is, maybe rather than editing, I would say refining this process. I don't know. I think that, like Birge, I'm convinced that the situation is so problematic, complex, and pressing that a degree of caution, but a degree of moving forward, are both necessary at the same time.
But then I'm a designer, so I care less. But I think, I think architecture and design, industrial design, or all design fields can really play a role and be super important, but we really have to grab it even more than we do today.
I'm not really sure where the process is, being something of an outsider, but it's probably a little early, I'm guessing, for an editing process. It may end up being some trial and error, but I think before any movement forward, the main idea would be communication, and that means communicating between designers and architects and the people that really understand the nature of the particular area where your project is located. That would be fundamental, I would think, to whatever the next steps might be.
I think also we don't, as designers, we still are not clear on a method for dealing with this kind of complexity, because you know, science and a lot of scientific disciplines that have a reductionist approach sort of will start off with trying to solve particular smaller aspects of that and build to larger solutions. And then, you know, from when you're talking about ecology, sometimes it's very hard to use that particular method to sort of jump the almost like trophic layers of complexity within things. And so I think one of our problems is we don't really have a method reconciling the ability to sort of gather and systematize information and then develop these very complex webs of information and then figure out where our kind of entry points for design are. And I think it's not clear there's one answer or another, whether you start with sort of small experiments trying to control a few things and then sort of move out, whether you try and move a lot of things at once but in a much more indeterminate manner. So I agree, I think it's like the only way we'll figure out if these approaches are viable is just by kind of starting to sequentially try them out and then I think also be pretty clear about when we do things, whether we think they're successful or not. Because I think we also have a bit of a problem in the communications loop of not being very good at saying, well, maybe this approach didn't work so well. You know.
And well, even after this communication and planning, it's so complex, it's still going to be a trial and error process.
Yeah.
And like you just said, judging the outcome is going to be a complicated thing to do as well.
Well, especially in the sort of riddle paradigm where he says you can't do that anyway, right? So I think that for all of us as designers, like developing methodologies to deal with these questions, I mean, you can see like all of us kind of have a little bit different approaches. It's sort of unclear that you could go through an editorial process without those criteria. So I'm not even so sure there ever will be an editorial process. Maybe it's like, maybe at the larger scale it's precluded, right?
I think you need to think about what the various functions of this matrix or this interface is, and that would help with kind of deciding how you appraise things, because it functions in many different ways. It may function to let things in or keep things out, or let certain things in or certain processes happen and not others. And I think in landscape ecology, it's maybe a good model to look at, because they have been concerned with that for a long time. And you could list out, you know, 20 or 30 functions of or properties of this interface. And once you articulated those many different properties, you could think about how a particular design might target one or the other, or how those things might work in counterproductive ways. I mean, you may not be able to solve all the different functions with one solution for sure, but you at least know what you're trading off. What are the trade-offs that you're going to have to make with a certain design? So that I was kind of thinking when you said that, this general idea of permeability or even semi-permeability of this interface or this membrane almost around the built environment. And that might be another sort of model to inform thought, you know, thinking about how these processes can or cannot move through the built environment.
I'm quite, I think, excited about the advantage that I think architects and designer has in being able to sort of exist across the boundaries between, let's say, a techno-scientific world and a sort of cultural artistic one. And I think that perhaps the where kind of our role can become quite relevant within this let's say situation is the one where we can somehow engage through our medium, which is mainly kind of drawing and building of interfaces or more larger or smaller, depending. And at the same time, create a product that can be received on a different level, which is much more kind of intuitive, and it's much more grounded in a kind of cultural discourse. So in this way, I think we have the opportunity to escape, if you want, a certain kind of reductionist environment, and somehow offer to a larger public certain ideas or certain tools and certain techniques in a format that is accessible and that they can use or they can engage with in a much more intuitive and spontaneous level. Because I think that's also the key. I mean, I think human beings are very good at making decisions based on a sort of intuition, more than we are in taking decisions after having to evaluate rationally 55,000 variables, right? I think although we have been trained in that way, I think eventually our instinct is what, you know, actually we are quite good at using in situations, particularly when there are situations of emergency, you know? So I think that is the, for me, what is quite exciting of our role in terms of becoming kind of mediators in that sense, no? Being able to load some of these technological tools that we have into a format that can be used in a much more effective way through our intuition, through our...
So maybe I can challenge you on the way in which you have opened your argument. I think we really have to be careful that we don't launch ourselves into a kind of fast-forward process on the basis of untested assumptions. You know, the statement that architecture bridges between the world of science and technology on the one hand and the artistic and the cultural on the other hand already suggests that there is a separation between technology and culture and science and culture. And I think today, if one really looks carefully, this is not a statement that can be upheld. I think we live in a culture that is very much transformed all the time by technology and by science and so on. So these kinds of dichotomies that are artificial and that have generated discourse for a while need to be rethought now, because if we uphold them, we limit the spectrum of our operation. That's why I'm so keen on making sure that the conceptual foundations on which we embark are carefully thought through. If we separate, if we continue to separate the world of science and technology and culture and the artistic, this already has tremendous repercussions for what we can do and what we cannot do.
But I mean, they are still strongly segregated.
I don't think you can say
particularly
that,
within
you know?
The I think we live, we research have, and academic environment,
I think
which
we
is
have
where
two
most
strong
of these
markers.
Technologies are developed.
But I don't think
I think we have two strong markers that this is not the case. I wouldn't even know on which basis one could say today that culture and technology, that technology operates outside of culture and science operates outside of culture, because we really live in a culture of crisis, in the culture of environment. And this culture of environment, which is a kind of sensibility that an ever-increasing number of people shares, is one in which which cannot separate technology and science out of this notion of culture. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really risky business to do that, to continue to insist on this kind of division.
But it's really a disciplinary problem. It's a problem of the disciplinary boundaries, where on some level, I don't think you're in full contradiction if your intuition is informed by certain knowledge and the knowledge is cross-disciplinary. And I think that the problem with the architectural discipline is that it's, despite the fact that it lets these influences of both the science and kind of artistic practice come into the place, the notion of, Jonas mentioned that, is sort of a notion of being a generalist, to some degree, I find problematic. And I think that what some of this sort of a new knowledge could bring in and is perhaps within academic structure to enable a certain degree of research which could inform the intuition and which could perhaps enable a greater stratification of a discipline. Because it's not that it's bad or good, but I think there is a kind of a lack of knowledge we operate on, and then we make assumptions which lead us in the wrong path. And I think that's Michael, where your cautiousness probably coming from, and your work, obviously, it's so deeply rooted within the research and the setting up the kind of a foundation to the disseminating of that knowledge, which is not really that common in the other academic environments.
I think the idea of going back to communication, I think, is quite critical in this. I've had the experience of working on many large projects. We did a project on Mount Etna for a big park after a volcanic eruption. I don't know, there were several different state agencies, civil defense, there were volcanologists, geologists, ecologists, there were all kinds of people. We had to sit around the table and agree about the right way forward. They decided to do a design competition from this, and all the projects basically started with this idea that everyone protected their own territory or their own idea about what they were going to do. And our group just started with a very, very different assumption. It was just that we actually just tabled an idea from not knowing so much about the problem, that we were going to do something about the situation for the next eruption. But just by putting this proposal on the table, the conversation or the dialogue we had became entirely about opportunities, about how we could work together to make this model work somehow. So I think the problem is what you actually put as a project or the model that you start working with, because you've got to be able to generate this first start. And actually what I said before is that the beginning doesn't have to be perfect. And I think design projects work that way, that the idea or the concept doesn't have to be right in the first place, but it needs to give you the space to be able to evolve it, to get other people to have an input, change the direction of it, and make it better. And I think in most collaborative efforts, it's about getting the start on the table so you have something to give generative feedback to. When it doesn't become just about outlining each one's own territory or expertise, because these projects, or according to my experience in a way, it's then these large collaborative projects become very difficult to work on, and they don't become necessarily creative or productive, because people have kind of fixed standpoints about in a way what their professional opinions are, right? And it's very difficult to generate new ideas from that type of dialogue or that conversation. So it's good to respond to something. That's kind of what...
Yeah, no, absolutely. But there's a difference between kind of a collaborative project where it's a model of kind of a consultancy, and there's a different about kind of a
defining a problem or a project, which comes back to the wicked problem and the thick boundary as sort of the kind of idea we were looking at with our work, is that what it actually is, it needs to be done or addressed before you even start thinking about making something. And so the kind of a modes of inquiry one needs to establish are the ones which need to be more informed.
Yeah.
And so it's even the sort of a pre-collaborative phase on a project where it's just finding out what the heck is happening there and what you're responding to. And I think that is really critical. And how you enable that is, you know, I mean, we're within here at Cornell, it's an incredible research university. And there's a lot of kind of, but at the same time, I think that the boundaries of the disciplines are being so tightly upheld that sometimes it's hard to set up certain venues for that kind of interchange to happen, so you can come to the collaborative table in form or to the, you know, so I think there's a little bit of a difference in the process.
I think a real challenge as well is that if you're designing an industrial product or a building even, you can go out and ask the customer or the end user what they want to see in that. The problem is if we're dealing with designing buildings that are friendly towards biodiversity, you can't simply ask that question. You can get at the answer, but it takes a long time and a lot of expertise. And in answering the question correctly, say for a bat or a bird, you might be giving an entirely wrong answer for a fish or a bug. So I would caution that perhaps an iterative approach needs to be made so that you look and reflect on what you've done in making your modification to a system and how that's subsequently impacted on biodiversity.
Yeah, systems have this nasty feature that they act counterintuitive in many cases, and we had a nice example today. Like the increase of birds in development areas is something that you would intuitively not anticipate. At the same time, I agree we need intuition more than ever, but I think also I believe in this Dreyfus and Dreyfus model of skill acquisition, where intuition is a feature of an expert. You have five stages of being a novice and becoming an expert, and you should be very critical to your intuition while you're still a novice. And you need an expert level, and then still you would have to remember this this nasty feature of the systems that they have a tendency to act counterintuitively. A person I really appreciate is Harold Nelson. He puts it the role of the designer in this way, as being like an adaptive expert. So you actually, what you learn is to be not a generalist who knows a little bit of all, but you really get an expert in being adaptive to new situations and to know your own limitations and to trust your intuition critically. So.
You know, we obviously saw some grand scale projects presented and that are apparently in the works, and I really think the first step should be small steps, because if small projects fail, you've learned something before you move to the grand scale projects. We're not talking about redesigning nuclear power plants where the failure would be disastrous. It would just be a learning process. Yes, you want to plan. Yes, you want to communicate. Probably compromise a little bit, but then go ahead and try it and see if it falls or succeeds, and you'll learn something from that you can start growing from those failures or successes.
I just want to go back to maybe what I was trying to touch on before. Because actually what I was trying to say is quite basic. I think in order to have something to respond to, maybe it would be interesting for us to see how we could contribute to one of the projects. Because I think, you know, to look at your project, for instance, about the bird populations, right? It immediately generated lots of ideas about what we could do and what we could do together. Mm-hmm. Right? So So I think it's an interesting thing to take a project or something to start from
as a departing
point, right, from a conversation. Because I think it would be interesting to hear just how people specifically look at the problems that you were addressing, for instance. I think we were all very fascinated by your talk before. And lots of these things we discussed about feedback and about larger system and about trying to understand that, I think that was all expressed quite clearly in your presentation. So I don't know. I mean, it's just because I like to see hear result quite quickly, and I'm very, very impatient. So normally I just want to, you know, like, and maybe that's a weakness or disadvantage in many ways. But
it's good.
I just think there's a way of starting a conversation that has a specific direction.
I think that's a really good point, because in a way, by having something to respond to in a context where you have multiple people from diverse backgrounds, you quickly understand the differences that you share in terms of communication in your language. And that, I think, is the initial hurdle that's so difficult, is how do you cultivate a space that enables productive communication? Because all the, you know, the different disciplines and the different players at the table will have different goals and objectives and deliverables to answer. And that starting point, I think, ultimately gives rise to a number of process-based discoveries that occur. So
Sometimes that's also just insight. Like, I was actually, because I was kind of thinking the same thing as you are about your presentation. And the first thing I thought of was that, you know, you were always measuring everything in terms of percentage of, like, forest cover. When the assumption that if it's not forest cover, it's like a building. And my first thought was like, well, yeah, but you could be both. How would you be both at the same time? Like, what would you design that would be both at the same time, so that all of a sudden that whole equation that you were talking about fighting with a developer over what was, you know, which falls into which category could be kind of, could you, how would you start to explode that in some way that you would gather that kind of duality of function? What would a construct like that look like?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, and I was thinking kind of along the same lines as I was thinking, how do I present this percent forest to architects? And it's a slider. You guys have a slider, as you just said, on what that percent forest means in terms of biodiversity or the bird diversity that I look at, because it could go all the way from being completely black and white built and forested, or completely green to green, from, you know, don't even see the buildings, basically. The birds don't even see the buildings. And that would be a way to start that discussion, is how do you change that categorization?
Or even sectionally, that you imagine that, like, the sort of forest has its kind of grounded longitudinal effect, but, you know, structures, yeah. I mean, I think of the Snowdon Aviary, one of my favorite buildings in London, you know, of this, like, wonderful tensile aviary, but also that through its sort of landform and structure, I mean, essentially creates three-dimensional habitat beyond a sort of certain expectation. So I think that, because I think that when we, there's also this issue we have, clearly, you and I were talking about before, was that, like, how do you engage with someone who's a developer who, until you explode that thing, you guys have no way to talk, because they have, like, I'm at 70%, mm-hmm. and, like, that's the only way I can make a buck. Or I can't, or even not just can make a buck, but can't even initiate the project because the financing doesn't work given the cost of the land and the cost of the construction. So unless we find some way to break that little moment, and this is sort of this real world thing that you're talking about, that, like, instantly those little points of, there are always those little points of, like, critical path points that if you can't get by, and that's where the insight from the other discipline, sometimes, whether from an architect towards something else, or from from a biologist to a physicist, those are those little points of inflection that are critical.
I mean, I think just to relate to that, I think Michael's conversation yesterday about the Nolli plan and what you can draw and what you can't draw, and I think that was directly related in a way to your model, which I think your model is great because you can predict something for it, but then there's obviously situations where the model doesn't work in a long time.
Absolutely. Mm. Those are the interesting ones.
Yeah. I'd like to open it up for hopefully some questions from the audience as well, or responses to any of the comments.
Following the same line, I'm wondering, David, what your reaction would be if
I'm not an ornithologist, although I was surprised to hear that some birds did better in the urban areas. But I don't think we can judge all of nature on birds. Birds are a diverse group, but they're a tiny, tiny speck in the vast sea of biodiversity. We tend to, again, emphasize the large things, the vertebrates, when literally vertebrates are about 1% of living organisms. So, again, there's a lot of stuff out there that you're never going to know about, you're never going to interact with, but all of that does need to be taken into account. The good thing is, and many others have pointed this out, is that when you do try to preserve enough nature for the big things to exist in, you have automatically preserved a lot of small things that you don't even know are there, because they exist in a lot of the space that you preserve for the big things, which is a good thing, a very good thing.
The real handy thing with birds is that people like them for the most part, and many people can identify them. And they encompass many different niches. They do so many different things, too.
I used to get upset that all the people concerned about the environment were concerned about seals and eagles and tigers.
Yeah.
But I finally came around to the fact that if you do conserve the environment for those organisms, you again are conserving nature, because most of those larger animals, especially things like tigers, require huge amounts of fairly natural habitat. Now, I guess architecture has nothing to do with the sea, but I'm also concerned about the damage we're doing to the oceans. But a little bit of that is linked to land use, of course, agriculture especially, perhaps building with runoff water, like I did mention today, build so that whatever water falls doesn't just get shed and run into a stream and then run into the ocean carrying who knows what. That's not a good thing either.
Can I just step into this discussion 1 second? Because I think there were a few times in the presentation in which this idea of whether nature is good or bad, etc., came about. But for me, there is an interesting question: is do we need to preserve any living species, or is it actually possible to think about preserving any living species, or isn't like natural that certain species disappear and other thrive and they evolve in a certain direction and then they disappear? Isn't it like the history of the biosphere, a continuous series of catastrophes, if you want, and people disappearing and other species appearing, and then the forest disappearing, and et cetera. Isn't it like, for instance, oil that we are using now to fuel our civilization, the remaining of forests, entire ecosystems that were wiped out? And so I'm trying to say, of course, there is a kind of objective which is about guarantee our life on Earth as much as possible, because that's, what we are kind of geared to try and do. But is it actually logical to think that it is, in fact, possible to preserve anything that is around us? Or isn't it actually natural that things eventually disappear and other thrive, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, you're obviously not a biologist. And I know that people have these thoughts, but apart from what I strongly believe is the innate value of nature, nature cleans our water, it provides our oxygen, it provides our food, even though we've modified nature vastly to do those things. But, well, I don't know if anyone's aware in here of genomics and how many very important products we're finding that certain organisms produce that we would never have dreamed that substance existed, or that it had these values or properties, some of which have medical uses, industrial uses. And if you just eliminate things left and right, there go all those really potentially important products. That argument has been made over and over and over, that nature really does have practical value. Again, I'm more of the it has value in and of itself, And I just ask what I think is an ethical question. Do we have the right to say that species is unimportant? To hell with it. I don't think we have that right. I really don't.
I just wanted to quickly address your question as well. I think there's one thing about whether or not it is sufficient to integrate a small number of species in relation to doing something for the environment at large. But I do believe in order to integrate, let's say, three species that are not domesticated and that are of a sufficient size so that you can see them, would require a fundamental change in the way in which we think about architecture, but it would also require a fundamental change in the way in which people relate to their environment. The example of the mice. you see, this kind of integration would... The other concern is the creation of a sensibility in that direction. So I think if it's only kind of semi-domesticated or domesticated species of pigeon, maybe there will be not much happening. But if those are not domesticated, and if this requires a total shift in terms of tolerance and expectation, that would be a fundamental thing to accomplish.
It's a social, what you're talking about is sort of reorganizing social thinking to include that whole conception, and that's the difficult part, that like in a way the agency of projects like these, even little projects, that's where their agency comes from, right? Mm-hmm. And changing the kind of social relationships that would enable that. And then that's the difficult part. Like it's not technically difficult to build something that's going to allow you to grow birds. That was your point. It's more like creating the social condition, the social desire to even want to do it, which is the heart.
We had a student here who wanted to. I think it's very nice to have some.
I just want to kind of see what you're talking about. And I guess one way to say it is, like, at what point is our kind of like manufactured, kind of like iron lung nature acceptable? And at one point, like, is it bad to interfere so much to keep a species alive that we're kind of like its soul? So it becomes a pet. I'm not wording that right, but I guess, like, is manufactured nature, this kind of like humanly continued nature, acceptable, or is it kind of not nature anymore? Kind of a human creation, like a building, or
well, anything? I'd rather try to engineer nature than to eliminate it. That's for certain. And I do think that what Michael said, building. To bring nature closer to people so that people would notice nature more, I believe is his thought. It just occurs to me that people that don't think about birds probably don't have bird feeders. If they had bird feeders out their window and started watching the birds, I guarantee you most people would get interested in birds. Same thing with whatever else we can design, you know, our structures to attract. I think it would be a valuable thing towards changing people's thinking. Get them away from those damn computer screens for a while and let them watch some nature is what I am all for.
Well, you see, intervention also requires a careful selection of the priority. And the priority, that's what I was trying to point out. The priorities can, on the two extreme ends, be either to preserve the current situation at all expense, or to engage in such a way that certain very specific developments or things that happen in nature, processes, can continue to take place. So I think if and when a species becomes extinct due to a natural process, we probably might need to let this happen. But if it would disappear because of some stupid thing from our side, that would be regrettable. So the real difficulty is how do we design, and design produces conditions like this. This is here now. This is projected to be here now in this particular situation, and this is where the project stops, versus thinking... How do you negotiate that with a whole series of open-ended processes that should be maintained in that kind of process condition? And I think that's where the system thinking comes in, because that allows you to coordinate processes of a very different kind.
Mike, yeah. Just to follow up on your comment there about maybe the three species or three beings or living organisms interacting, maybe. I think I'm just a beginner of this, but we've been working a lot with ecosystem models this year, and we've been doing a survey about what we could find. And, okay, it's beginners, but I think what we didn't find so much was either biologists or ecologists who looked at the whole ecosystem. But there seemed to be a lot of specialism, and we got lots of models on either fish or on birds or on bacteria or other things, when they built amazing models for how their specialism thrived and lived and so on. And the only thing they had that as an input variable in this was biomass. And I guess it's just food or energy for them to survive. But there was no other connection between how they interacted in these models. So it seems like every scientist have had their own specialism looking at their area, and then the model ends at the interface with the interaction of other species.
But that's a whole, ecology in general has had a lot of issues. I mean, I have a couple of friends who are in the ecology department here, and I mean, I've had conversations with them with the incredible difficulty of starting to integrate those kind of simulation models at larger and larger degrees of complexity. I mean, I think part of the thing is we think that the problems that we're struggling with, I think a lot of them are reflected in other disciplines in a sense. Like, I think the ecologists would like to. I know some ecologists who are not probably sitting too far who would love to be able to start integrating each of their sort of like community population small scale, like Anurag Agarwal, who built small scale models of like little forest communities of like four species here. And he would love to start complexifying his model, but it's really difficult. I mean, I think that's the other thing we have to
acknowledge. But there are people working on it, basically.
But it's also a whole different thing in terms of ecosystem modeling that you're looking for. That's you model energy and nutrients there. You don't worry about the species, basically, those ecologists that work at that level. And the community and population guys, they're definitely scaling up to look at more complexity.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I think Melissa has it.
Yes. Following from the comments about, in some ways, how we cannot get away or we cannot escape our worldview, our particular anthropocentric approach as coloring our understanding of ourselves and ecologies and biologies and the relationships between, I think, following from some of those comments, I think it's interesting, or I have observed a migration of sorts throughout the day where I think the potential architectures that have been imagined maybe have been measured or were earlier measured by a metric of biodiversity or, taking biodiversity as the metric by which to measure potentially more beneficial architectures. But throughout the day, it seemed that we moved towards or moved away from biodiversity specifically towards a more encompassing notion of diversity with Christina and Efren specifically. And I wonder if you guys could maybe talk about, in some ways, your approach, some of the approaches that we saw throughout the latter portion of the day seemed to not, it seemed that there wasn't an attempt at a non-anthropocentric architecture, but rather that it integrated or took into account absolutely our very fundamentally anthropocentric position.
I think one of the main, listening to you, I think we are speaking about ourselves mostly. We are speaking about ourselves as humans, you know, in relationship with our species, instead of like, because it's quite difficult to take into account what are the species, what are the needs, what are the, you know, the fundamental things. So we were speaking about preservation, right? Because it's the very first quick action that could be done, you know, in order to start thinking about what to do. And I think, I do agree, I think, with most of the comments, but I think one of the main things is how, as architects, we can influence to ourselves, as society, to be aware of these situations and to construct publicly our own notion of nature. What is amazing, at least for me, that have been like working on design things during a lot of years, what is amazing is that our notion of sustainability, our notion of nature, in such a small period of time, has changed a lot. And has changed, taking into account scientific knowledge, but as well, public constructions of notions about nature, about sustainability. What was a problem 10 years ago is not anymore a problem. So what is really important, I mean, in our how as architects we can influence, how can we have an impact on that, is through the construction of the induction of public discussions about these kind of things through the design itself, instead of trying to sort out problems, let's say, or to trying to be efficient. That, of course, is necessary to do, but it's more, even the impact would be even more bigger, let's say, if you try to reconsider what are the roles that nature or the interrelationships what are this notion of nature? Because we are speaking about nature and we have no idea what nature is. It's, you know, it's something very strange because we are referring to something that is culturally constructed, that is constructed by us. As humans, and this is something that is really, really, I think, the crucial problem.
There have been multiple human concepts of what nature is and what it's about and what its value might be, but let me just simply say that nature doesn't care what we think about it. Nature is what it is, yet we do have thoughts about it. I don't know where to go having said that, but I don't think we need to just say, well, here's an opinion about nature and accept that as truth. I'm not a postmodernist. I don't think everybody can have their own truth about the real world. I think there is a real world, and nature is the most interesting part of the real world for me. And, you know, you can't have multiple views all being correct about what nature is, because they'll all differ on whether it's important or what to do with it or how much of it to preserve or whatever. And that's just total chaos. We can't succeed if it's just total chaos and everybody's view is valid.
Do you agree?
I won't buy into that.
Do you agree about a basic thing, that our notion of nature is affecting effectively our nature? I mean, it's doing nowadays. I mean, we are affecting, as humans, what nature is. So we should challenge our notion.
Honestly, the scientific view of nature has evolved tremendously within my lifetime. And I've changed my mind about what nature is all about within the last decade. And it's amazing.
I think also there's an issue that we go through, which we also kind of have to confront, which is we want to say we have to take into account politics, but I think we really have to take it into account, because there's a whole kind of apparatus which is extracting, from an economic point of view, enormous rents from natural systems, enormous rents. And that system has a lot of vested interest in maintaining those rents, and it's also a system that is very good at sort of subsuming its critics and then sort of expressing the critical point of view in such a way as to kind of sanitize it. And I think that's actually something that's happened pretty seriously with this discourse on sustainability, which is kind of very system which has created these difficulties, has in fact subsumed the rhetoric and then kind of spat it back out in a completely not meaningful manner. And so I think that the thing we have to be really, really careful about is that when we talk about these ideas of a conception of nature, we think about affecting the system. We want to affect a kind of cultural system, but we also don't want to, and I don't quite know how to deal with this, but we also don't want to feed into a way that these things can be kind of co-opted as a kind of greenwashing. And that's where the sort of, I think, what Michael's talking about of it being careful is really important. It's very easy, and especially with us as designers, we are often have to be really I think we're often tempted into being seduced into sort of producing some sort of something that produces a sort of political condition, which in a way is a bit false. And I think that's a sort of serious, I don't know how to respond to it, but it's a difficult situation. You know, what do you do when, like, freaking Monsanto asks you to do a project about, like, showing how green, you know, how invested they are in sort of certain kinds of green agriculture? It's like total crap, but at the same time, you'd love to do this cool project. That's the dilemma, that's a sort of architectural dilemma in a very concrete model.
Also, it's quite interesting to see what happens when you just, for one moment, change your viewpoint. You could say architecture could be a vehicle by which we check how we think about nature, and therefore nature is sort of the discussion subject around the table, and we might disagree on that. You could also say nature is the vehicle by which we sort out architecture, and then architecture becomes the discussion subject, and then we will have a very different conversation around the table, but we will find that architecture is all of a sudden equally quite unintelligible, and that the real effort needs to be made on a conceptual level to make certain things intelligible so that we can have a debate. So I'm not really sure. I was oscillating today between the different presentations where I wasn't sure, was architecture the vehicle to sort out a view on nature, or was nature the vehicle to sort out a view on architecture, or both, or neither? So unless one puts a particular kind of proposition on the table and says it's precisely this, it's very hard to get the match in the conversation. So I don't know. I'm a bit uncertain about where each one around the table stands. So maybe you could maybe just clarify a little bit where your standpoint is. Is it you trying to sort out through architecture what nature might be as a social construct? Or is nature the vehicle by which you sort out what architecture is as a human construct? Or I'm not sure.
Okay, let me say that what is happening here is that we are speaking about the expertise level, which is okay. You know? But what is happening is that in that expertise level, we don't have any. We have a little impact, very little impact. What is happening with with the world outside, so we can actually design a building with some features or directions. What I think is really important is to make people engage, about this notion of what nature is, and to be aware that this notion of nature is an artificially constructed thing, okay, and. Both integrating the notion of what a nature is in the building design, instead of like saying, I'm going to have like a kind of a direct approach to the design itself through like a kind of efficiency or just optimization, right? So what I'm trying to say is that architects have like a really really important part in the discussion as well. Could have like an important part of the discussion, not only about basic, specific decisions in the design itself, but as well in influencing how we should look at nature as well through the constructed environment. And I think this idea of the question that you were making me as you were posing me as well is a kind of a redundant thing, right? So, and what I think is important is that. Having in mind what is our role as well as cultural activators, not only as designers, but maybe architecture has been doing not absolutely okay, but in a way quite reasonably okay, was like saying, okay, that's a problem with the built environment. We can tackle, we can start working with. We have no idea how to do it, but there is an important issue on how the resources manage, how it can be in a way instrumentalized, and how our notion of what a space is could potentially change what is happening outside our world.
There seem to be two separate issues. On one hand, there is the concept of nature, the sort of anthropocentric concept of nature as we perceive it, right? And there is nature by itself, which you can't escape from its reality beyond our own existence. And it's interesting because this whole notion of non-anthropocentric kind of keeps coming back as a within an agency of architecture, right? Like how agency of architecture can engage the non-anthropocentric issues. And I would actually argue that even though I believe that there is the kind of the reality beyond us, which is not exists beyond us, I would completely agree with you on that, is that as soon as we engage in the agency of architects to interact with that world, we cannot escape the notion of anthropocentrism, right? And so in that sense, this idea of biodiversity and the constructed landscape, in a sense, what you're doing, Michael, to me, it's anthropocentric. I think it's good. but how do you, I'm not quite sure how you separate that from the sort of a, what's the knowledge, acknowledgement of a certain agency, what we can do and how we can separate ourselves from ourselves.
Well, you see, when I was trying to test that thought model on myself, I found it also very difficult to see how you move the human concern out of the center. But I found it relatively easy to imagine how you move another few species also into the center. Right. And in that regard, I think this issue of getting two or three species involved is already a very fundamental change, because by sharing this central position, all of a sudden it becomes, in a way, less important as a...
I totally agree with you, and I'm really engaged and in awe with that sort of way of working. I just the only thing I was saying is that as soon as you realize that the biodiversity is, for us, a method to engage as an agency for our survival, it becomes an anthropocentric endeavor to some degree, right? Like, it's not that you're not engaging in scaling up the environments to engage other species, right?
Stay away from philosophical entanglement, because it just allows you to move forward.
Oh, but maybe, like, actually, the way I was interpreting, I wasn't sure what did you mean by non-anthropocentric at the beginning, so I was trying to figure it out in my head. And, I mean, the way I was interpreting that, it wasn't so much that suddenly as an architect I don't serve the interest of human beings as such, but rather that I don't see serving the interest of human beings as an action that is in opposition or detached from engaging with the natural environment. So as such, for me, the barrier or the distinction between natural and artificial, what I do for a human being, what I do for a bird, sort of dissolves. So maybe the center is not a center anymore, it's a kind of meshwork that engages in multiple levels with multiple relationships. So in that sense, of course, I'm doing my interest in a way, or the interest of my client, but at the same time, that doesn't mean that I'm separating his interest for the this kind of meshwork of relationship within which this operates, no? So I mean, that's the way I was. I don't think there is necessarily a conflict between these two.
Marco, it's interesting because actually the discipline of architecture has always had that idea of the sort of how we construct ourselves in relationship to different stakeholders. So I think Michael's really asking for that as a kind of expanded discourse because, you know, if you think about this, when you practice architecture in the United States, you're given a license, right, by the state. And in that process of giving you a license, you're sort of given a dual responsibility, one of which is you have the responsibility to produce something for a client. But there's also the implication of a social contract that you're going to pretty much, it's almost a negative social contract, you're not going to produce stuff that's going to cause like horrible problems for lots of other people, like your thing is going to catch on fire and then New York City will burn down, or probably Chicago or whatever. And so in a way, like, you know, if you think about it in those terms, there is this kind of almost sense of the expansion of that implicit social contract, which has always been a part of an architectural sort of dichotomy in terms of who we serve. And of course, then there's this sort of third interest, which is this sort of individual interest in our own particular idiosyncratic interests in the development of the built. And like, you know, clearly, I think one of the odd questions is how you sort of balance all of those things across. I mean, you know, I would say generally right now, the profession of architecture is mostly interested in its clients, not here in academia where we get paid by somebody else, but in the world where people get paid by clients, they're very focused on their clients.
We have another question from the audience.
No.
Yeah, I was just, this goes back to Michael's notion, and I really appreciated the construction of the relationships that you posed last night. But I wondered with this discussion and with all of the work if we can ever extract a human dimension given the political, economic, social consequences, both on the level of an architect's engagement individually with the client, but at a macro level. How do we extract a kind of legislation out of the question of ecology and nature? How do we extract a human interaction which is profoundly effective on natural environments? I don't understand how the model can be exclusive of that.
No, I think there's already quite a great deal of work that shows how legislation can be drafted on the basis of a focus on biodiversity. There's already a lot of literature out there that is pointing towards ways in which parts of industries can be reorganized in relation to this kind of focus. And anyways, I don't think that our profession nor the kind of contractual relations that we have are static. They evolve, only that maybe the biggest resistance perhaps comes from places like the Architectural Registration Board in England, who really want to say this is what you should train because this is what's needed in practice, as if practice was a static condition. One cannot deal with these kinds of things. I think even the French need to realize that language evolves and they need to be open to some English words in their language. Everything changes. We're not in a static condition. And the way in which we begin to engage and begin to suggest certain things, and when we have opportunities to sit with multiple stakeholders around the table and even with policymakers, that's the inroad where small gradual changes are made. At the same time, we have to put demonstrations into the world that are feasible and that are, in a way, approachable from an analytical point of view. It doesn't necessarily have to be a quantitative analysis, it can be a qualitative analysis. In other words, a lot of small structures and tests that can show how certain things work.
You know, I would suggest that under our social contract, where the students actually have to have other responsibilities, we should take this conversation, which is just warming up,
yes,
into the dome, and thank everyone for participating. It's been a great symposium, and we'll continue under the dome. I'd like to thank all the students and others who have come here and participated, and especially all the participants.
I just want to, again, thank all of you for having come from far and wide, and some not so far and wide, but I think it's been a wonderful series of and this discussion tonight was I think, great and helpful things together to say that we didn't even know an hour ago. So I think that's
yeah,
wonderful.
Yeah.
The questions are tough, but it's the question of our time. And I think it's a shame that more people
Ha, 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 ha.